You could call it Donald Rumsfeld's famous law of unintended consequences.
There are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
In Iraq, what we don't know is still deadly more than 5 years later. An insurgency you can't see has doctors treating war casualties under siege. The superbugs of Baghdad, things we do not know how to fight. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, July 9th, and we're taking a look at a microbe that's attacking U.S. troops in Iraq and puzzling doctors. Iraqi leaders demanding a timeline for the withdrawal of the American military. Medicare, will your doctor's fees get slashed? Will you still have a doctor to go to? Outsourcing the news in Florida, grammar's gone to India. That and all the news. In Turkey, officials say at least six people were killed after a firefight outside the U.S. consulate in Istanbul. Armed men in a car opened fire on a guard post outside the complex, killing three police officers. No one has claimed responsibility. Iran has test-fired a missile whose range puts it within reach of Israel. This comes one day after an advisor to Iran's supreme leader said Iran would respond to any attack against it by targeting Tel Aviv. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has downplayed threats against the U.S. and Israel.
Iraqi police say a bomb has killed five people and injured 15 others in Fallujah this morning. A crowd gathered after an explosion went off outside a bank. Then a second blast ripped through the area, causing the casualties. While G8 leaders say they've agreed to a timeline to cut greenhouse gas emissions in half by the middle of the century, the leaders of developing countries, the so-called G5, which includes China and India, say they can't endorse the mid-century goal. President Bush has said China and India have to endorse the pact.
The other nations agreed that they must also participate in an ambitious goal with interim goals and interim plans to enable the world to successfully address climate change.
The president's last G8 summit ends today.
Russia says it'll be forced to initiate a military response if a U.S. Czech Republic missile defense agreement goes through. Russia's ambassador to the U.N., Vitaly Churkin, spoke after U.S. and Czech officials signed an initial agreement.
Every military action causes a military response. This is a fundamental rule. This is what military people are about.
The White House is criticizing Russia's claims. It says the system is designed to prevent threats from rogue nations such as Iran.
After falling more than $5 a barrel yesterday, oil prices are trading up slightly today after the missile firings in Iran. The Dow is up more than 1% yesterday. The S&P starts trading at 1273. And we're thinking about lost and found stories. Have you ever lost something that you actually found and never expected to? Did you ever find something that nobody claimed and so you got to keep? We're going to be talking about some doozies that were found in Iraq by U.S. soldiers.
I always find useless things.
Looting.
Like Walkmans.
Right.
In 2008.
Have you ever looted? We're actually going to be talking about looting in Iraq and the legacy of that situation 5 years after the war. Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Looting on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Some well-meaning promises and political pragmatism at the summit. And we're covering it this morning. Two big stories out of the Group of Eight meeting in Japan. Yesterday, the world's richest countries signed a pact to cut greenhouse emissions in half by 2050. Calling climate change one of the great global challenges of our time, the nations officially set a target that will be difficult to reach. They also revealed that eight is not enough. The richest nations on their own can't have an impact on issues like global warming without participation by other emerging nations. So if riches can't buy you a sustainable environment and eight nations are not enough to reach a useful consensus, perhaps the bigger story is, what do we call an international quorum in the 21st century? Joining us from Rusutsu on the island of Hokkaido is Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times, who's covering the summit. Cheryl, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
First of all, on the climate change agreement, who's on board, who's not, and how realistic is the goal?
Well, everybody's on board a little bit, and the goal is not what advocates would like, so we'll see how realistic it is. Essentially, the Group of Eight, the rich countries, said they want to cut carbon emissions in half by 2050. The poor countries say rich countries have to do more. They want wealthy nations to take aggressive steps to cut emissions over the next decade, and they haven't signed on yet to the 2050 target. Hmm. The whole thing goes to Copenhagen next year, where the UN is going to be negotiating an international binding treaty.
You know, what's interesting here is how this becomes a sort of preliminary round of something that the UN is going to take up. I mean, I alluded to it in the introduction. I mean, what we're seeing here, aside from a well-meaning attempt to deal with climate change, is also a transformation of international law. I mean, are the G8 agreements binding in any sense? Certainly, we've seen that the eight nations alone can't really do that much without a broader consensus.
Well, I think what we're seeing is a transformation in international relations. The G8 agreements aren't binding on anybody. They never have been. And in a way, that's what makes this meeting significant. What makes it significant is the fact that countries across the spectrum, rich and poor, have come together around this issue of climate change to lay the groundwork for something, the groundwork for something that the UN can later do. And that actually is important, and it hasn't happened before. So at least these countries now are on record as saying, yeah, this is a problem, and we intend to do something about it.
You know, somehow the non-binding nature of the G8 summit and the participation by the so-called G5, it seems to me, encourages a kind of candor that might not be possible if we were having to nail things down in a more UN formalized process. But do you see any sense that this going from non-binding to binding process is becoming more formalized, that initiatives begin in a place like the G8 and then make their way to the UN, and that this is what we're going to be seeing more and more of over the century?
Well, I wouldn't say this place is rife with candor. I mean, if you read these communiques, they're more bureaucratic gobbledygook than one person could possibly absorb. And that's because the people who write them know that they're going to be taken seriously and that they are going to be examined by the UN. And these documents are, in essence, a recommendation to the UN from these countries saying, this is what we think you ought to do. This is what we're putting forward. So they're very carefully negotiated. And they do carry weight for that reason if they are non-binding.
Do you see an 8+5, G13 by 2050?
You know, it's funny, part of me thinks that they ought to just ditch this whole G8. In fact, I asked at a press conference yesterday of non-governmental organizations, I said, why do they even have this meeting? It's grown so unwieldy. You've got the G8, then you have this so-called Outreach 5, and now we have the major emitting nations, which are 16 plus the European Union. I mean, it's kind of like a mini UN here. Why do they bother? And the answer came back that, you know, the process of having the G8 is important. And in fact, it was the G8 process that moved President Bush to really start taking up the issue of climate change. He'd meet with these leaders and they'd pressure him, leaders like Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, and his buddy Tony Blair in Britain.
Right. Who the president called a constructive force for change yesterday, Angela Merkel. Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Cheryl is covering the G8 summit on Rusutsu, which is on the island of Hokkaido, which closes today.
John, the latest debate this week swirling around Medicare and Medicaid has pitted doctors against insurance companies, and in between you have about 100 million patients. At the heart is a bill on Capitol Hill that would prevent a 10.6% cut in pay to doctors treating patients that was supposed to begin on July 1st. Both sides have hit the airways, spinning dire predictions. Here's the American Medical Association.
Call Senator Sununu. Tell him to make patient care, not profits, the priority.
And here's America's health insurance plans, a private insurance trade group.
The last time Congress cut Medicare Advantage, over 1.5 million seniors lost their plan. Tell Congress, stop cuts to Medicare Advantage.
Anna Matthews, who's covering this complex and messy debate for the Wall Street Journal, joins us now. And good morning, Anne. Certainly lots of rhetoric. What's really at stake for millions and millions of people who are covered by Medicare?
Good morning. Well, the answer is nothing quite yet, because although the physicians are very alarmed about the prospect of a 10.6% drop in the payments they get from Medicare, those reduced payments haven't actually taken effect yet. The Bush administration announced that they would not process claims at the new lower rate for the first 10 business days of July, which takes us through the middle of next week before anything dire really happens.
So on the table at the moment is a proposed bill that overwhelmingly passed the House and is now in the Senate that would prevent those cuts.
That is correct. The bill is likely to come up for a vote, and this would be the second vote on this particular bill and the third vote on bills of this type, because there was a similar bill that got a vote previously. So that vote is likely to happen today or tomorrow.
So on the one side, you have the American Medical Association. What's the doctor's position in all of this? There's certainly been some anecdotal reporting that doctors are saying, should these cuts pass, they're going to have to stop treating some patients or stop taking on Medicare patients.
Well, the doctor's position is they don't want to take a 10.6% pay cut, which is pretty understandable. I think none of us would be eager to have that happen to us. And they're eager to see that fixed as soon as possible. The doctor's more long-term position is they'd like to see this stop happening, because every year and sometimes every 6 months, depending on how long a Band-Aid Congress passes, this situation tends to come up because of an automatic formula that kicks in that cuts their pay if the growth rate is excessively large, according to the formula.
And on the other side, you have the insurance companies who say choice goes out the window if they are the ones who take cuts themselves to make up for the doctors increasing payments.
Well, there's a lot of rhetoric on both sides, and no one ever likes to take a cut. The insurance companies are concerned because one of the main ways that this bill would pay for the doctors' new money, as well as a bunch of other things, is to take some money out of a type of private Medicare plan called Medicare Advantage. And it looks at two specific ways of doing that, one of which is unacceptable to the Bush administration and to some Republicans, which is why you've seen the delay here.
You know, there's a talk in those ads about how this relates to seniors, but in fact, what Americans don't widely understand is, Anna, that Medicare is so huge that it actually functions as a kind of a price fixer for the entire industry. So the reimbursement formulas that are set for Medicare patients are going to ripple their way through the private sector in certain cases as well. How does that work?
Medicare does, in effect, set rates for the entire health system because it is so large and because it's a government payer. The expectation, though, I think from private insurers and from the rest of the health system is that this 10.6% cut is not going to happen. So I doubt you'll see private insurers cutting their reimbursements to doctors based on this, because everybody pretty much expects that this cut will not happen, as Congress has repeatedly managed to head off these cuts in the past.
And the current proposal has the support of Democrats in the Senate, and they're looking for one vote from Republicans to bring them to the number they would need to override the president's threatened veto?
That's right. And as is often the case in Washington, there's a lot of shadow boxing going on here. Both parties are in favor of saving the doctors here. Nobody wants to anger the doctors on the eve of an election or to annoy Medicare beneficiaries who vote in many key states on the eve of the election. But the difference of opinion is over how to pay for it. The bill that is going to be up this week did get very strong Republican support in the House. In the Senate, it came one vote shy of the 60.
One vote shy.
Exactly.
Anna Matthews, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much. Reporter for
the
Wall Street Journal.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We are still getting responses from our call out for your favorite summer song. And on our website, DHP writes, I have no idea what the kids are rocking to these days, but I'm all about Pavement's Summer Babe. Today we're asking you about Lost and Found. What have you lost or what have you found? There's always a story behind those. Let's hear your story, 8778, My Take.
Amazing John? Stuff that was unclaimed and you got to keep. Those are the really happy stories that we're looking for. It's actually related to a story we're going to be doing about Iraq in a moment, but here's another Iraq story. You've heard of IEDs and Al-Qaeda in Iraq targeting U.S. soldiers, but how about Acinetobacter baumannii? Say it fast. You can't see it. It is stopped by no checkpoint. It can penetrate any green zone. It is a hospital-bred bacterium that has become resistant to antibiotics. In its drug-resistant form, this bacterium has been plaguing doctors in Iraq treating U.S. casualties since the war began. It preys specifically on the wounded with weakened immune systems or people vulnerable because they're connected to catheters and breathing tubes or have open wounds. Soldiers who are picking up this microbe in hospitals along the evacuation chain out of Iraq are bringing it back to the U.S., where those who have never even seen a battlefield can become infected. Dr. Michael Smith is a microbiologist. He worked for years in an effort to outfox this impenetrable drug-resistant bacterium. He's featured in a Nova Science Now episode that airs tonight. Dr. Smith, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
We've got a U.S. invasion here, right?
It seems so. It's been infecting hospitals around the world, so we've got to deal with it.
Now, Acinetobacter baumannii is one of a number of drug-resistant bacteria that the healthcare industry is trying to deal with here. What is unique about this particular bacterium?
Yeah, you know, this particular bug seems to have found a real soft spot in sort of the human relationship with bacteria. And what I mean by that is it's found, you know, antibiotic resistance, but not just resistance to everything. It seems to have organized its resistance in a way that really will confound us going forward. One strain was isolated that had 45 drug resistance genes in a single easy to share packet, so they can just sort of share it with all their friends and continue to be drug resistant to everything that we have available to us. So in the 70 years that we've been putting together antibiotics, it now has resistance to all of them.
Now, is this because this particular bacterium has been developing an immunity by being in contact with antibiotics, or is it because it's a fundamentally different kind of organism that because of hospitals and particularly the situation in Iraq, it gets deep into the body and is therefore more destructive for that reason?
I think it's a little bit of the combination. I mean, certainly exposure to antibiotics selects for resistance, but it's something about this particular bug that leads to the organization. It has an ability to organize its genes in a fashion that I don't think we ever appreciated before. And so that's a bit scary to see how a bug can take all of genes that are related to each other and stick them in one spot.
Scary indeed. Here's some sense of the fear from someone who's watching her husband in intensive care deal with something they never expected to be dealing with.
It seemed impossible to me that someone could be in a war and be hit by a bomb and survive this and then be actually felled by a simple bacteria in a hospital.
It's from Nova Science Now tonight. That's Lee Woodruff, who's the wife of the ABC News journalist Bob Woodruff, who was injured in Iraq by a blast, but then had to fight sepsis and this particular bacterium to stay alive, even though doctors were able to treat his serious blast injuries. Dr. Smith, how does the blast, the nature of how people get injured in Iraq, assist this bacteria in being so destructive?
Well, it's an opportunistic pathogen, and so it infects people who are immunocompromised. And When you undergo a stress such as a war wound or something like this, your immune system is compromised, and that's the way it gets in and stays in. And since we can't really treat it very well, these multi-drug resistant ones, it just sticks around.
Now
it can be very bad.
Yeah. We alluded to this idea that you've been trying to outfox this bacterium. What sorts of therapies and strategies that we haven't used in the past need to be applied here?
Well, one thing that I think we've come to understand about bacteria in the last few years is that they don't live in isolation. They live as communities, and they communicate with each other, and as a collective can undergo developmental changes such as conjugation, so they can en masse begin to mate, or they can en masse begin to activate virulence strategies. And so if you think about it that way, as a sort of collective organism that's invading you, that you could, rather than come doing what we've been doing, which is sort of bombarding them with antibiotics to try to kill them, maybe we can communicate with them in a way that they're communicating with each other and sort of interfere with that communication. So rather than bombing, go with diplomacy.
And diplomacy, in your mind, is really about focusing the attention on figuring out the DNA of the bacteria and then trying to confront it with some kind of re-engineering method.
That's right. You need to understand how they're talking to each other first order to figure out how we can talk to them.
So you need to focus your therapies in the actual mating process so that people don't pass along their immunity and, in fact, reduce their immunity. But I'll tell you, the whole thing sounds like a Michael Crichton screenplay, Dr. Smith. I mean, a conspiratorial bacteria taking down soldiers in Iraq and bringing it over to the United States. But it's absolutely real.
That's absolutely right. And one other thing that we should try to keep in mind is our best practices in hospitals. So, 100 years ago before Pasteur, doctors didn't wash their hands in between surgeries. And now we realize that that's not a good idea. And I think there are practices that are going on now that we'll think later, why did we do it that way? Such as, wearing long-sleeve shirts and wearing ties that could be pulling bacteria around from patient to patient. Things like these can be changed and limit the transmission.
Well, Dr. Michael Smith, you're one of the central characters in tonight's episode of Nova Science Now, which airs on PBS and is a co-production of WGBH, our partner here on The Takeaway. Dr. Smith, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And now, headlines from Femi Oke.
Hello there. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour, emerging economies, including China, clash with G8 over how to fight global warming. Russia warns it will react with military force if the Czech military defense shield is deployed. And an attack against the U.S. consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, has left 6 people dead. A heat wave in California will stick around until the weekend, and that's making the job of fighting the state's more than 300 active wildfires more difficult. A wind-stoked blaze northeast of Sacramento has burned 40 homes and is threatening thousands more. 2 FARC guerrillas who were detained last week in a mission that freed 15 hostages are facing extradition proceedings today. The Colombian government plans to act on the request to clear the way for the rebels' extradition. The White House is denouncing Iran's testing earlier today of a missile that could reach Israel. The U.S. is warning Iran to abandon its ballistic missile program immediately. And that's a look at some of your domestic and international news headlines.
Thank you, Femi.
Oh, you're welcome.
What, no Jell-O today, Femi?
No, we say Jell-O for Friday.
Those of you who are new to The Takeaway understand that Femi Oke has an issue with Jell-O, that if you listen to our program, you'll hear more about it. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome. I don't have issues.
Jell-O issue.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Wednesday, July 9th. And this week, presidential hopefuls Barack Obama and John McCain were speaking to Latino voters. Yesterday, they were at the nation's oldest Latino advocacy group conference in D.C. And that's just one of the 3 major stops at large Latino gatherings this summer. Come November, Latinos could be a key bloc in swing states. Fernando Pizarro was covering the event yesterday for the Univision Television Group, and he joins us now. Good morning, Fernando.
Hi, good morning, Adora.
How did they do yesterday, talking about the economy and immigration? Let's start with John McCain. I understand he got a standing ovation.
He did. He did. Just as you said before, this is the second of three appearances both candidates will make basically within 3 weeks. They will be at the convention of the National Council of La Raza next week. McCain, I believe, is speaking on Monday, and Obama is speaking on Sunday. On June 28th, they spoke at NALEO, which is the National Association of Latino and Elected and Appointed Officials. But yesterday, McCain did get a standing ovation, so did Obama. The good thing for McCain is that, unfortunately, at the NALEO appearance, there were some people from Code Pink who got in, and somehow, in spite of all the Secret Service security and, I guess, accreditation that NALEO had arranged, and they did heckle them. Heckle McCain a couple of times at least back in June 28th, but this does not happen yesterday. And McCain apparently he did a good job. He talked about patriotism. He remembered when he was a prisoner of war that he had a one of his other prisoners of war that he was with him was also a Latino.
And he certainly did talk about immigration. Let's hear a bit of his speech.
Many Americans, with good cause, didn't believe us when we said we would secure our borders, so we failed in our efforts. We must prove to them that we can and will secure our borders first, while respecting the dignity and rights of citizens and legal residents of the United States of America.
Fernando, one of the criticisms that you often hear about mainstream politicians is that when they go to a group like African Americans or Latino, they sort of treat the group as one group with one interest. McCain talking about immigration in this audience, was it the thing that everyone cared about the most, or was he really speaking to some people more than others?
Well, you're right. There is this conception that Latinos right now, all they care about is immigration. And the thing is that poll after poll, including polls made up by Latino groups like NALEO a few weeks ago, come up with the issue that immigration is only one of the priorities. And the same has happened in previous elections. The same happened in 2004 when, let's say, immigration wasn't at the forefront of American politics, but it was important for Latinos at the time. And the same happened yesterday. McCain talked a lot about immigration, so did Obama. McCain did admit, and we had a one-on-one with him later, together with a couple of other of our competitors. And we had one with Obama 2 weeks ago. And he did admit that with Senator Kennedy, they had failed twice in passing immigration reform. He did talk again about border security. So at least he's not, in a way, talking only about immigration reform. He is putting out his message that border security must come first. He says that the governors have the ability to certify that the borders have been secured, and then we can proceed to immigration reform. But
so he really went in depth on how he sees immigration reform should be handled, as did Obama. And Obama made another point that is often talked about. Let's listen to a bit of his speech.
This election could well be decided by Latino voters.
Now, Fernando, you've been covering politics since 1992, and every couple of years we hear that this is the year that the Latino vote is going to make a difference. But this year, the Latino vote could be decisive in some of the swing states like Colorado and New Mexico and Nevada. What's your take?
Well, yeah, we've been hearing this, the Latino vote, for so long. And back in 2004, we heard the same thing, that the Latino vote was going to be a big deal. I mean, we could say that maybe we all know that Bush got a lot of the Latino vote in 2000 and 2004. There are some signs, however, that this year could be different. As you may know, there are a lot of campaigns, especially after the immigration marches in 2006 and after the immigration reform failed in 2007, to make a lot of, there are approximately 8 million eligible permanent residents who are not American citizens yet. And there have been enormous campaigns by some of these same groups, by LULAC, La Raza, NALEO, including sponsored by our own company, to make them, to make them become citizens.
Well, certainly there are turnout issues that are going to make this more critical. But I'm wondering if you could tell me how, you alluded earlier to how the group is different, that it's not like simply Latino voters, that there are various kinds of issues. Do different issues bear differently in different swing states? And how is that likely to play, between now and November?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I would say probably border states care more about immigration, even though, as you well know, immigration is basically filtering everywhere now, and it's becoming a top issue everywhere. But everybody says that the economy right now is the number one issue, followed by the Iraq War. So basically, we're seeing very, very few differences if we compare it with the priorities of the Latino vote back in 2004. But the question that I have, for instance, in these appearances is, how relevant are these appearances for the regular, I don't want to say the regular Joe, but let's say the regular Juan or Juanita voter out there? I mean, how important are these appearances? Because the Naleo, for instance, is a very limited group of elected and appointed officials. We go from senators to regular school board members who attend.
Fernando, my guess would be that you don't necessarily think it's terribly relevant. We just have a few seconds left.
That's right. I don't necessarily think it may be completely relevant, or that the regular voter may actually get to see these speeches and hear what the candidates have to say.
Fernando Pizarro, Washington correspondent for the Univision Television Group. Thank you for joining us.
That's the takeaway. That's the takeaway. Regular Juan and Juanita.
Juanita. We have the latest headlines now from Femi. Okay, Femi?
Hello there. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the hour, members of the G8 have agreed to harsher sanctions for Zimbabwe. Anheuser-Busch is suing InBev, the Belgian brewer, aiming to take over the company. And at least 6 people are dead after a firefight outside the U.S. consulate in Istanbul. Also watching for Senator Barack Obama. He'll be appearing on the morning TV shows in about 20 minutes' time from now. French President Nicolas Sarkozy says he will go to the opening Olympic ceremonies next month. Mr. Sarkozy had threatened not to attend because of China's human rights abuses in Tibet. And that's a very quick look at your news headlines for now.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adoree Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
And this week, John, we came across a very, very interesting story. Iraqi police came upon a strange discovery, and then they made a successful recovery mission. And this is a story that began when a tipster told police that he knew the location of a remarkable treasure.
Gold diamonds?
Gold diamonds. Not quite. The cops followed the tip to an orchid in Baghdad. Maybe there's some symbolism there. And buried beneath the sand, they found 5 classic cars, including 2 Rolls Royces and 3 sports cars that once belonged to Saddam Hussein's son, Uday. An Iraqi police colonel broke the news, and here he speaks through a translator.
A police task force had been set up to pull the cars out of an orchard, and actually the cars were taken to the headquarters of the 7th Brigade, Iraqi National Police. By doing so, we've prevented armed groups from taking them outside the country to sell them at astronomical prices.
Buried cars.
Astronomical prices, because it's well known that Uday was notorious for his love of cars. In fact, he once drove a pink Rolls Royce to vote in an Iraqi referendum. Who do you think won that referendum?
Boy,
maybe
his dad? I think overwhelmingly. 99% was the turnout there.
No one knows exactly how many cars Uday had or where they were kept, but his toys became the perfect prize for looters, which brought back a lot of memories for me, because the days following the U.S. seizure of Baghdad in April 2003, there was lots of looting, and I was there to see it. You had just hundreds, dozens of people running through various stores, and particularly in the neighborhoods where they'd never been necessarily allowed to go, very wealthy neighborhoods like the one that Uday lived in, and they were running out with cars or driving with cars and televisions and radios, and they were spectators. People were driving up, families, mothers and fathers, sons and daughters. They were just watching it all kind of unfold, and nothing was safe from antiquities, from the museum.
Well, they emptied the museum. It was funny because I remember Don Rumsfeld saying, the Secretary of Defense, saying, stuff happens.
Which didn't go over too well. There was a lot of resentment. Iraqis felt the U.S. military spent time protecting the oil fields, but they didn't protect some of their national treasures. U.S. troops did take a lot of heat for not stepping in and not protecting the museums and other special Iraqi monuments. Some of that confusion and chaos in responding to the looting by the U.S. military was caught in the 2003 Frontline documentary called Truth, War, and Consequences.
We try to stop them from looting, they don't understand, so we'll take their car and we'll crush it. United States Army, tankers, whore.
You can hear...
That's what you get when you loot.
You can hear the chaos there. There's no real enforcement going on. I mean, I remember I witnessed looting in Zaire when...
But they weren't shooting at people in that clip, just so we're clear.
No, it was just it was an attempt to just kind of, you know, have a showdown. There was no organized attempt to deal with
the situation.
And that's the problem with this kind of chaos, social chaos. I remember in Zaire, the currency and the inflation was so bad that riots occurred. And one day I remember seeing in Kinshasa, the capital, a line of people who were looting copper pipe and drywall and lawn chairs and office chairs and just walking in a long line, miles long in the city. It was really sad.
Yeah, that's the flip side of it, because we were at one of Uday's houses. Who knows how many he had. People were stealing knives and forks and plates.
Yeah, he had good
and
stuff,
chairs
though.
As well as billiard tables and balls and driving off in these cars and taking artwork and clothing and shoes.
I remember,
just about anything you could grab your hands on in someone's home, and it was an enormous home right on the Tigris River.
An opportunity for looting, but a terrible legacy for the people of Iraq.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Join the conversation, won't you, at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We were talking about the lost and found stories. Have you ever found something that was unclaimed and you got to keep it? Have you ever witnessed looting? We were talking about that a moment ago. And our focus is continuing with the situation in Iraq. And you may not be aware of negotiations that are taking place between the Iraqi government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and the U.S. about the arrangements after the end of this year, when the U.N. mandate that allows the U.S. to be in Iraq runs out. The negotiations will determine the U.S. role in Iraq to an extent that perhaps the presidential candidates, who are talking about Iraq quite a lot, may not have much ability to change. It's the strongest statement ever made regarding political negotiations between the U.S. government and Iraq. Yesterday, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki announced he's considering a timeline for American troop withdrawals from Iraq. It may be a hardline political stance. It may be a trial balloon. Wayne White, former deputy director of the State Department's Middle East Intelligence Office, joins us. We've been having periodic conversations about the long-term intent of the U.S. in Iraq. What do you make of this latest trial balloon or statement by Nouri al-Maliki, Mr. White?
Maliki is engaged in a delicate political balance. He has in his constituency many Iraqis who are opposed to occupation, and because of past experience with the British during the colonial era, extremely resistant to any compromise of sovereignty, particularly bases. And I think the U.S. side overreached on the sofa, going for immunity for contractors who are very, very much disliked.
Let me just, it's an acronym alert there, Wayne White. SOFA is the Status of Force Agreement, right?
Exactly. Right. Yeah, it determines the status of U.S. forces and forces connected to them in a country, from bases to what courts you're tried in and things like that. And I think that we probably shouldn't have gone for the immunity to for contractors and trying to get control of bases into the future, considerably into the future, is just a hot button issue because of the Brits and the British and what they had done. Now, Maliki wants us there.
Maliki cannot survive in his shallowly rooted government without a U.S. presence. And so what he's trying to do is give his critics enough to shut them up while keeping us there. That's why this morning there was a comment in which an Iraqi official said the timeline might be something like 3 to 5 years from now, which surely gives us enough time for the U.S. to deal with various timetables.
So the incredible irony here is the survival of Nouri al-Maliki actually prolongs the U.S. presence in the country, whatever the presidential candidates say, right?
Exactly. And, you know, we have to raise bottom-line issues here, even if, let's say, John McCain is elected and he said, you know, we could be there 100 years. John's going to run into a lot of problems related to expenditure. You know, how long can the United States bear the burden of all this, particularly at a time when we're in recession and the average voter is under such stress? It could very well be that John McCain will have U.S. troops out of there in a time frame like 3 years or 4 years, just as this one Iraqi source said this morning.
When you talk about the motivation of Prime Minister Maliki, you talk specifically about his constituents. What about the legislatures who actually have to approve this agreement? And then secondarily, is there any concerns about regional influences, i.e. Iran? Is he responding in some way relative to that?
Well, the legislature for sure is a concern because he can make whatever deal he wants. But the very forces that oppose, you know, sort of giving away the store are in the parliament and would vote down embarrassingly something that did not show that Maliki had given, had taken a few bites out of the original U.S. Package in order to sort of save Iraqi honor. That is very much on his mind. The Iranians also want us out, that's for sure. But in this case, there are such strong Iraqi nationalist emotions involved. I think that's primarily what he's reacting to.
Well, it's a complicated set of dynamics, domestic pressures, regional pressures, and also U.S. political pressures determining these negotiations. It sounds like what you're saying is we're looking at maybe 5 years. The negotiations are going to deal with what happens over the next 5 years. Wayne White, former deputy director of the State Department's Middle East Intelligence Office, thank you very much for those insights.
My pleasure.
John, did you know the American newspaper business is struggling? Did you know that?
I do know that.
And so does one Miami Herald copy editor.
Hello, this is Braden Sims coming to you today from outside the Miami Herald. I've recently been notified that I will be losing my job, so I'd like to talk to you today about finding a new one.
That's Braden Sims as he introduced himself, and that's actually on the Miami Herald website. Braden Sims joins us now. You're 26 years old. The Miami Herald has been your first job. What happened?
I got laid off is what happened. It's that simple.
Because your copy editing job is what's happening to that? They still need someone to look over everything, don't they?
Well, you know, Miami Herald just laid off about 250 employees. But my department happens to be one of the lucky few that is being outsourced to India.
To India?
To India, that's correct. Mumbai, if I remember correctly. So my job's been outsourced to Asia, essentially.
Also joining us now is Roy Peter Clark, a senior scholar at the Poynter Institute. Roy, copy editing gone to India, is this common?
It's a unimaginable new trend to save costs, and I find it heartbreaking, both for young copy editors and aspiring journalists, and of course the veterans who sort of constitute the, you know, the defensive line of American journalism. Nothing against the terrific journalists and copy editors in India, but you know, it's not just a mechanical, grammatical job. It also involves cultural literacy, institutional memory, and all of those things are being lost, and that's to the detriment of the public.
Mr. Clark, you say it's unimaginable, but television has been using foreign TV shooters for years. There's all kinds of foreign individuals who participate in the production of journalism on many, many different platforms, and there are hundreds of millions of people in India who speak the Queen's English very well, thank you very much. Why should newspapers be any different than any other industry?
Well, you know, I don't think I'm a pretty smart guy, and I wouldn't feel competent to copy edit the work of journalists in India.
And you mentioned the cost in terms of the content. You're saying that there's a grammar, and then there's also the institutional familiarity with the subject matter. But in terms of the cost, I mean, we're talking about a company, MindWorks Global Media, that hires 90 young men and women, and they sit there day in and day out, 7 days a week, three shifts, copy editing things from China Morning Post to the Miami Herald, and they say they'll save companies up to 40-50%.
You know, I'm a little old school. I want somebody to yell at if they mess with my copy. I mean, I want somebody to talk to collaborate with.
So you're talking about...
I want somebody who understands what St. Petersburg, Florida is like, who understands what Albertson, Long Island is like, and I want somebody in the room, or at least
You're talking tradition, something that Braden Sims, at least at the Miami Herald as a copy editor, you're really not going to get to experience. Any responses to your cry for a new job yet, Braden?
Oh, actually, yeah. The internet support has been overwhelmingly positive. Received all sorts of sympathies throughout the world. Actually,
so when are you moving to Mumbai?
I'm in talks with someone over there, but
oh, really?
The salary is considerably lower than I would hope.
Braden Sims, we wish you all the best of luck. Braden Sims, Miami Herald copy editor, soon to lose his job, and Roy Peter Clark. Thank you to you. Roy Peter Clark is a senior scholar at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Thanks a lot.
Keep the faith, journalist.
Keep the faith.
Courage.
Just had to slip that
courage,
one in there.
Courage, as Dan Rather would say.
And keep your responses coming to anything you've heard on today's show. You can always send your stories to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
We're talking about a microbe that's attacking troops in Iraq and puzzling doctors. And we're also talking about summer songs. Here's one from you guys.
It's very calming.
It's Nathaniel's summer song. He said it on the takeaway.org. My favorite summer song is entitled Summer by War. It's slow and cool and easy like a mint julep on the veranda.
And John, here's the takeaway for today. See if you can guess the place.
I wouldn't say this place is rife with candor.
The G8
can
summit.
Can you guess?
No more calls. We have a winner. That's the New York Times' Cheryl Gay Stolberg, who joined us from Hokkaido, Japan, at the G8 summit. What about the 2008 beefsteaks, Adora?
Well, this morning, we're predicting that two women will be running with John McCain and Barack Obama in November. What do you think? Wow.
For another week, you're bidding on Alaska Governor Sarah Palin for John McCain. Stay with us. You can contribute. We're always on. It's The Takeaway.
877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.